Welcome, everybody, back to this session. We're starting a bit late because we were waiting for the Secretary General, who's doing some interviews, but he still hasn't finished. So we'll start without him. Is Japan here or not?
Yes.
Oh, here, but we're not. We haven't got a video. Have we got a video link? I can't see any pictures.
No, I think that's not happening.
Oh, that's not happening. Okay. So I thought we ought to be welcoming Japan, but it's obviously not happening. But welcome anyway. This session is called 21st Century Challenges to the Transatlantic Alliance, and we have two speakers. The first is going to be Espen Eider, somebody I've known since he was 9 years old. I hope he won't mind me saying so. He is State Secretary in the Royal Norwegian Ministry of Defence. And our second speaker is Mr. Jonathan Marcus, the Diplomatic Correspondent of the BBC World Service. And I think there are some really major questions to be asked, quite frankly, now about the role of NATO in the 21st century. And some have to do very much with the nature of the Transatlantic Alliance itself. What is its particular value added in a globalized world? If we say that, do we really think that Islamic extremism, which was hinted at in the previous section, has somehow substituted for the communist threat? And isn't that quite a dangerous assumption to make? And the other is, what is the role of a military organization like NATO, which after all was designed to fight a war which it never fought, on the model of the Second World War? It was traditional fighting. Last night I was hosting General Sir Rupert Smith, who is arguing that that kind of war is over. And we now operate in what he calls wars amongst the people. Is there still a role for military force in these wars amongst the people? And if there is, what kind of a role? And is it the same? And can we think, and I think particularly in the case of Afghanistan, what's the role that military force is playing there? Does an attempt to defeat the Taliban actually undermine political efforts to do other things? Is there a link between the two, following up on what the Secretary General was saying earlier? So these are my sort of questions to our speakers, and I will let Dr. Eider start, and I'll follow with Jonathan Marcus.
Should we go up there?
Which would you prefer?
Rather, yes.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Mary, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me here. I think it's a very important part of the job that the Secretary General and the leadership of NATO is doing, that it reaches out and engages in the public debates. And I know the Secretary General quite well, and I know that he has a very strong commitment to make those debates real, that we shall address the big issues that we are discussing internally in the alliance, also with the public, because that's the best way to present an alliance which is trying to grasp with a whole set of new challenges which are in many ways unfamiliar to the alliance, to other organizations, and which is the make or break for making this alliance relevant also for the 21st century. And I would just like to start by reminding ourselves that in historical terms, there is not much doubt about the historical relevance and success of NATO. First, it's 40 years where it clearly helped keep the balance and keep peace in Europe and in the transatlantic realm, and providing one of the most important frameworks for a strong Western unity in difficult times. Then when we moved into the 1990s, we saw big debates in the several ministerial meetings and several forums in NATO about what NATO was about to do now, that the service it originally provided was not any longer in the same kind of demand. And the alliance did adapt to a new set of European, particularly European challenges. I think we can group them into three. It was the ability to deal with peacekeeping in the Balkans, the first years in support to the UN operations, air support, naval support to the UN operations from 1991. 1992, and then from the end of 1995 by providing land forces under UN auspices in Bosnia, later in Kosovo, Macedonia, and so on. Secondly, in this 1990s phase, it provided the framework for assisting the transformation of Central and East European countries, a way that the new political establishments could focus on two things that they agreed upon: the need to join the European Union and the need to join NATO, and in order to get there, to make the necessary transformation, for instance, into civilian control over armed forces and the transformation of the armed forces itself. I think that has been a tremendous positive impact provided by NATO on continued stability in Europe. And the third part of that phase was that it again provided a transatlantic forum for Russia management, an inclusive way of Russia management, which, by the way, I think is still a theme that remains relevant and maybe may become more relevant again after a few years of less focus on that part. When we are now discussing the 21st century challenges, we are also entering a kind of third phase of NATO. And as I said, there are issues about the reach of NATO. Should it become global, or should it limit itself to have global partnerships? What is the scope of the organization? What is the number of tasks it should undertake once it takes on a major job, like, for instance, Afghanistan? We'll come more back to that. What is its place in the European and global institutional architecture? What is its relationship to the EU? Secretary General just addressed some of the remaining rather complicated issues about NATO-EU relations. And what is its relationship to the UN in a period in which the UN, contrary to the expectation of some, is regaining a political clout on the world scene, partly because of the failures of unilateralism that we have seen a few years ago, and a new recognition of multilateralism as important. What does NATO do then? What is the role of NATO in that setting? And, of course, how do we institutionally adapt to these challenges? Let me quickly mention a couple of points on institutional reform. That could sound boring to outsiders, but the way you organize yourself as an organization, as an alliance, is crucially important when it comes to the way one is able to project power, project political influence outside of the organization. And I think that, to be very frank, NATO's political transformation and the recognition of a new set of issues, new set of challenges, a new set of tasks, has gone well beyond the institutional adaptation to that new recognition, which means we have a vision expressed, among other things, in the comprehensive political guidance, the level of ambition, etc., which portrays a modern 21st century forward-looking alliance. But we have a command structure which is very big, in the views of many, too big, and too separate from the civilian side of the system compared to what most of us do domestically, where very many NATO members and other countries with which it's natural to compare ourselves are more moving towards integrating civilian and military leadership for an overarching strategic clout. These are challenges on NATO's agenda. The Secretary General is doing a great and important job in addressing these issues. We, from the Norwegian side, fully support him in his efforts. But it should be said that even for a Secretary General, there is a limit to how much he can transform his own organizations without the support of the member states. And when we come to the member states, we all see, and this is a collective critique, self-critique, is that we are, in a sense, often agreeing on the principle of massive reform, but we don't like it when it comes to the few things we like particularly well ourselves, our part of the command structure, etc. And we want to be one of those countries. I think another one is the host country of this conference that want to address this, not for small reforms, but for major reforms of the institution. On the issue of global outreach, I think the right balance here, and I think this is a quite important political point when it comes to the communication from the West with the rest of the world, that we should avoid creating the impression that the ambition is a global alliance as such, that we are reaching for membership from all parts of the world, among countries particularly close to us. I think that will be counterproductive and create impressions which were not the ones we wanted to create. I think what we should do, and again, I agree with what was said at the outset from the Secretary General himself, is that we want global partnerships to be more formalized. There are some countries with which we work more than others, and there should be a way in which they have a say, they have an influence, they have a formalized contact with the alliance, but that's not a globalization of the alliance, but it's a recognition of its place in a globalized world, which is something different. And that it's important to get that part right. I mentioned the UN, and I think that working constructively in a forward-looking way with new thinking when it comes to NATO-UN relations, I think there are things NATO has which the UN needs. And I think there is global legitimacy and an ability to project, to work along very many aspects of reconstruction, for instance, that the UN has, which we as NATO need, and that is one of the keys, I think, to success in the future. Then the chair of this session, Mary Calder, raised the question in the previous session, which I would like to address quickly already now, and that is, what is the success criteria? When does military force work? There is actually more knowledge about that than one would think. There has been systematic research and lessons learned studies from public institutions, private institutions, international and national research center from military organizations since the early 90s. We have a body of intellectual thought and a political experience which I think is relevant in order to start addressing and answering that question. But what we do not have is a big answer which really tells the whole story. I think that the couple of things I'd just like to highlight just to get us started on that is that using Afghanistan as the example, the most complicated operation of NATO ever, if we do not count the fact that we kept the Third World at bay, which is still the biggest success, but the most complicated operation as such, I think that the military force should be used in such a way that it underpins the overarching psychological management of impression, of expectation, of perception of the ordinary Afghan people, and today I would say particularly the Pashtun part of the population in the south and east of the country, that their future is better served by the project that is offered by the Karzai government based on the Loya Yirga constitutional process and the new parliament and so on, supported by NATO, the UN, the World Bank and the EU, than the Taliban project. That does entail the need to use force, at times offensively, in an offensive way, but it's very important that military force in itself is geared to underpin that overarching communication strategy, which is the international community support to operations. I think that's what, part of the answer, the management of perceptions. What we want to influence is the individual rational decisions of ordinary Afghans, also in the south and the east of the country, that they should invest in their own future in such a way that is compatible with this overarching strategy. And while societies and organizations at times are highly irrational, individuals looking after their family and clan and immediate kind may be quite rational, but we have to influence those rational impressions. And the second part is what Mary herself addressed, the importance of building strong institutions so that once we have left with our current style of presence, there is something after us to continue, and that is management of education and agriculture and transport and health and all those civilian issues, but it also police, judiciary, prison system, armed forces, border guards, intelligence services, all those institutions of power which any society needs. And again, the principle has to be, there as everywhere else, that these institutions have to be both effective and legitimate, not either effective or legitimate, but both effective and legitimate at the same time. And that may sound obvious, but we have experience that suggests that at times it's difficult to combine in an effective way. What I think is one of the challenges that are coming out of the current developments in Afghanistan, after NATO quite recently took over responsibility for the whole of the country, is that while we have a lot of effort, military effort, we have the OAF and remains of the Operation Enduring Freedom, we have an expanding NATO, we have UNAMA, the UN presence, we have the European Union, the World Bank, the G8, we have all the UN institutions, the World Food Programme, we have the NGOs, as has been addressed. they work together. I think liaison works, information sharing works, everything could be better. But what we lack is a place to go for the big strategic debate. Where, I mean, if we want to discuss the overarching international strategy for Afghanistan, where do we go? We could, of course, take it in the NATO Council, that's part of it. We could go to the Security Council, another part of it. We could discuss it in the EU, we could discuss it with Karzai. But there is not one forum, and this began well in the sense that the Bonn process provided such a forum for the big picture. But a lot of people with long-term experience in Afghanistan are now addressing the issue, where is this forum where we can discuss the strategy as such, precisely to address the kind of issues that that Mary was just mentioning. And there was a question about values, which I'd like to pick up on. I think for an alliance as NATO, as well as any other multilateral organization that I would like to belong to, it is important that we do not only project values and work to inspire others to believe in the universal values that we hold dearly, but that we also apply them while we are doing it. And I think we've seen some examples recently of what's happening if we forget that point, if we, for the cause of a higher good, accept a deviation from basic standards. That is so easily used against us or against the West or against those trying to do it in such a way that it clearly underpins this macro communication. This is a moral point, but it's also an operational point because it is easier to do the job right if we are perceived as doing it in the best of minds and with a clear legitimacy and a clear principle standard. That's what I had to say as the opening when it comes to the issues of operations and so on. I would just mention, although I very well know that the next panel is on energy security, that I, since I have the floor, I just mention that we from the Norwegian side, for quite obvious reasons, are very eager to see that this becomes a core item on the agenda of NATO, not because we think energy security requires the old set of military responses, but because it is a part of the new set of security challenges, and some of these challenges should be addressed in this organization, and I'm happy to see that that is happening. It also means that while we are engaged in faraway places, particularly like Afghanistan, there are also issues closer to home which remains relevant. And I think, to be very honest, as a politician, that we should see that if the alliance is only associated with things taking place far away from our own shores, we may have a problem of communication. I think it is important that Europeans and North Americans, Canadians and Americans, perceive that NATO is providing something also in the home area, and I think there are some challenges coming out of this new set of issues within the energy field which may provide that settlement. And this, of course, should be said while celebrating the good news, the very good news, that the military tasks in Europe are basically over. The classical military tasking base in Europe is over. That's not the problem. That's what the alliance was set up to fix. So if we should sort of be sorry about the fact that we do not have a major military threat in Europe, that would be doing it wrong. But there are some challenges out there, and I'm looking forward to the continued debate. Thank you, Mary.
Okay, I'll go straight over to Jonathan Marcus.
I'll come and stand here only because there's a mighty TV camera in the way and you won't be able to see me. I notice I'm the first non-official, non-NATO speaker, so I suppose I'm likely to be the first that's going to go off message a little bit. But I hope you'll treat it in the spirit with which it's delivered. I've watched NATO now for some 25 years or so, and I mean, there's no doubt it is a very successful organization. It's still here, even though the principal reason for its creation has disappeared. Unlike many international institutions, it's an institution that actually does things. For all the talk and the NATO Council meetings and so on, there are practical, real things that it has done on the ground and still doing. I've watched, particularly in the Balkans, the very early steps in NATO's involvement in nation-building and peacekeeping. And obviously, inevitably, the habits of NATO cooperation and so on have obviously paid dividends in other operations, be it the invasion of Iraq or the removal of Iraqi forces earlier from Kuwait. I just want to begin with a short story, because back in December 1991, I think it was, just a short while after the coup attempt against Mikhail Gorbachev, when he had been kept away and cantoned in his dasher, I went with the Royal Navy ship to Sevastopol in the Crimea, which was the first visit by a British warship since the Second World War. And one of the high points was a trip to Balaclava, which we were told was a naval base. I wanted to go there because of the history, and you know, you remember the pictures. It's almost like a Cornish harbour, very enclosed, with steep cliffs and a little Phoenician lighthouse right on the top, and it looks exactly as it did in the pictures in the Illustrated London News. And our party were walking along the quayside, and I noticed a British naval officer next to me with his camera over his shoulder, and he was walking along with the shutter firing, like that. And I said to him, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Shh, be quiet, don't say anything." And I said, "No, seriously, what are you doing?" And he said, "Well, that submarine over there, we've never seen. We thought it existed, but you know, it's very, very new, very hush-hush, and I'm taking some pictures." I said to him, "Well, look, over there is an independent television camera crew filming the whole blessed thing. The Russians don't care anymore. Ask them for a copy of the film, and I'm sure they'll let you have it." And I say that just to show how ingrained and entrenched old attitudes and old thinking can be, and how quickly and dramatically things change. And it's very hard to give up old habits. And I think the problem facing the Alliance, the problem facing really all institutions and organizations today, is dealing with change and uncertainty. What sort of organization is NATO going to become? What will be its place in the wider international architecture of the future? And if we just think back for a moment, I mean, when I joined the BBC, even though I look remarkably young, it was a good sort of 25 years ago. And when you started out in those days writing about defense, you were writing about, Russian tank ammunition. Could it breach the armor of NATO tanks and things like that? I mean, how the world has changed. Who would have imagined that the first time that NATO actually fired a shot in anger, it would have been back in, I think, February 94, when American jets, I think, shot down four Serb Galeb aircraft near Banja Luka who were violating the no-fly zone. If we stretch the 20th century a tiny bit, who would have imagined that the first time that NATO would invoke Article 5 of its treaty would be in the wake of the attacks of 9/11 in Washington and New York? So an extraordinary period of change and extraordinary things happening which one cannot predict. Now, I think what's interesting is that NATO has obviously, one of the reasons it's still here, is it has done an awful lot to change, and it would be foolish to suggest that it hasn't. But it's been changing in a period which I think is fast becoming a rather strange sort of interregnum or temporary period in the history of the international community. It's this period when Russian foreign policy appeared to disappear, the Soviet Union disappeared, and with it, its foreign policy. NATO expanded, it took in more partners. We appeared to be heading towards a world which was a kind of Pax Americana, NATO being an institution which was closely tied with the transatlantic relationship and with the United States, would change and develop within that climate. Now, I think it's increasingly becoming clear, not least because of the problems that the Americans have had in Iraq, that this is very much a temporary period of history. The international system is changing dramatically. I'll have a little bit more to say on that in a moment. But in this period, NATO adapted. It brought in partners. It extended its reach. It brought in, as members, countries who had even been part of the territory of the Soviet Union. And this extraordinary range of institutions and overlapping committees and bodies was created, so much so that they put up in the NATO Press Center in Brussels this extraordinary organogram, this diagram of NATO's interlocking security institutions. And it was so ludicrous and complex that journalists actually used to get themselves photographed in front of it. And in due course, I think Jamie had the thing swept away and they redecorated. In this interregnum period, we've seen all sorts of problems continue from the past. As organizations, other organizations have tried to develop in the security sphere, The duplication of the past has been repeated by duplication in the present. You only have to think of the Western European Union and NATO, two competing naval forces operating in the Adriatic during the troubles in the Balkans. Today, again, duplication by both institutions with regard to Darfur. So, the challenges of the 21st century. Well, I think the essential challenge for NATO is redefinition, both of itself and of the tasks it carries out. And I think three things are changing. The nature of the security threat is changing, the international system is changing, and therefore NATO itself must change. If you think about it, the whole definition of security now has changed. It's like one of these extraordinary Edwardian postcards of a train crash, and you see all these wooden carriages telescoped together into a single amorphous mass. Foreign policy, defence policy, domestic economic policy, questions of the security and intelligence services, all of these things, in a sense, are now pushed together. And, I mean, if you had a notional amount of money to spend and you wanted to cope with the problems that we now face from Islamic extremism, for example, where would you put the money? Would you put the money into job creation schemes in Leicester, in Bradford, whatever it may be? Would you spend more on the intelligence services? Would you spend more on the high-end capabilities of the armed forces? And the reality might be that you would probably spend much less than you would imagine on the high-end, purely military side of the equation. You're facing an extraordinary range of new challenges, from the breakup of states, from international crime syndicates, and so on and so forth. And in this sort of world, social cohesion as an element of security is probably as important, if not more important, than military clout. The key question for NATO is which slice of this pie is it going to focus on particularly? And importantly, what parts must other new institutions play a role? As I've said, I've characterized the recent past, as it were, as a kind of an interregnum. And I mean, there's no doubt the international system is changing. It's changing dramatically. This is all obvious stuff, the rise of China, rise of India. But if you think about it, the rise of Iran in the Middle East. I mean, because of the nuclear prism and the proliferation problem, and if you listen to American spokesmen, it frequently sounds as though Iran's rise is in somehow, a malign plot that is only perpetrated by the mullahs who are desperate to obtain nuclear weapons. But, the reality is, if you look at the size of Iran's economy, the size of its population, you look at its history and so on, its rise in the region is as natural as the rise of China and the rise of India on the broader stage. It seems to me that an awful lot is blamed on President Bush and this current administration, which is undoubtedly, I think, speaking personally, made many mistakes. But remember, the tensions between Europe and the United States were there during the Clinton administration. They relate to fundamental differences between European and American society in age structure and history and background and the mission which these societies believe they need to perform in the wider world. And this, of course, means that any body like NATO, which enshrines this transatlantic link, is probably more important. I mean, you can take the argument from sort of Syria and Iran. If it's more important to speak to your enemies, well, I don't think within NATO people are quite enemies, but it is more important to have these institutions that that foster a transatlantic dialogue when there are going to be these tensions. And these tensions will continue into the next administration, whatever political hue that administration may have. So, the international system is more uncertain. U.S. hegemony is less and less assured. The flat world of Tom Friedman, the extraordinary benefits of globalization, is only one side of the equation, and we see more and more people writing about the darker side of globalization, the malign effects of globalization, and the fact that in many cases it is the actors on the bad side of the equation, the crime groups, the syndicates, all sorts of shadowy groupings, who are much more fleet of foot, much more agile than governments. So to conclude, I think there is still, whilst there's been a lot of change, there is still too much of the old NATO. I remember going to, every year, the big conference in Munich, big security conference, which for us, one of the benefits is that you always get the US defense secretary going along. And a couple of years back, Don Rumsfeld was there, and as he was coming into the hotel, and it was just after he'd made his famous remarks or infamous remarks about old Europe and new Europe, and I sort of shouted out to him, "Oh, Mr. Secretary, you know, what's it like to arrive in old Europe?" And he kind of looked at me and he said, "Gee," he said, "you know, when you get to my age, old is a term of endearment." Well, that's maybe one way of looking at it. But, you know, for NATO, old cannot be a term of endearment. It's changed a lot, but it's got to change a lot more. It's got to be leaner. It's got to be meaner. To use that awful word, it's got to be more relevant. It has to have the right military clout, and above all, it has to have the political will to use that clout. It is clearly farcical that an alliance like NATO cannot find very small numbers of helicopters to facilitate operations in Afghanistan. Second point, it needs to really rethink, I think, its public outreach and its whole public diplomacy. With respect, Secretary General, the alliance is no longer has the centrality in the security debate that it may appear to have from Brussels. In Britain, when we speak of operations in Afghanistan, it's the British Army in Afghanistan. Second mention, it's the Canadian Army in Afghanistan. NATO is somewhere in the equation, of course, but it's not perceived, I think, in quite those terms. Much more effort, I think, needs to be put into shaping public opinion and public perceptions of what NATO's role is. It can't just be a residual insurance policy. And I think last of all, NATO can't do it alone. I think it's more and more evident, and I mean this is no extraordinary insight, but it's more and more evident that the institutions that essentially ran the 20th century world are just not fit for the purpose of running the world of the coming century. And in fact, changing those institutions is much, much more difficult than it might first appear. And on that measure, you might argue, you look at the problems over UN reform and so on, NATO has actually done really well in a comparative sense in terms of the changes it has made. But it isn't enough. And I think one of the greatest difficulties is that we lack a clear organization that is really going to be in the business of the civil side of state building and civil reconstruction and so on. And that, in a sense, brings us to Afghanistan. Because, I mean, quite clearly, NATO is a very important part of the equation there on the military side, but it is only, if you like, context building. It's providing the context within which other institutions must act. And I think there is a great danger here, and I mean, this is ultimately last point. It comes down to national governments. There's a tremendous tendency in the media, I'm sure, and perhaps in the public mind as well, to condemn institutions. It's NATO's fault. It's the EU's fault. Why isn't the UN doing more? It's kind of alphabet soup of competing jurisdictions and overlapping responsibilities, which I don't think is sufficient for the task in hand today. And the problem is that the real problems, in a sense, fall between the cracks in the organizations. So NATO cannot do all of that by any means in terms of the civil restructuring and so on, but it must decide what it's going to do. I think it must have a much clearer sense of where its boundaries lie. I'm not for a moment suggesting that global partnerships are a bad thing. The outreach to the across the Mediterranean and so on is clearly important. But I think, you know, it does have to begin to start deciding, is this an institution that is just going to grow forever like Topsy? You know, are Russian concerns in Georgia to be waved aside, and ultimately we will have Georgia in the alliance as well? If we have this network of partnerships, why is it so important that all these countries necessarily join the alliance? Can they not just be some form of enhanced partner? And I think very importantly, as a number of speakers have said, geographic concern in a broad sweep doesn't make NATO necessarily a global policeman. So it's really honing down the purpose of NATO, the range of tasks it needs to perform in this new world, and then being able to go out and proselytize and convince people of the role that NATO has to play. But at the end of the day, you know, it's public opinion that matters. And if public opinion and governments are not prepared to spend the money, really modest sums of money, really, on defense expenditure, are not prepared to push governments to act in far-flung places where perhaps important principles at stake or important security matters are at stake, then it's going to be very difficult, I think, and very difficult for the alliance to adapt in this much more turbulent and uncertain world. Thank you.
Very much, John. Now, before I turn it over to the floor, I'd just like to say, make a few little comments myself. Ooh, I don't know why this is making this funny noise, but it stopped. I want to make a few little comments myself, partly, I have to say, because I notice that I am literally the only woman on the platform for the whole day, and I think, doesn't that say something about whether NATO is adapting to 21st century challenges? And partly because I have actually spent some time in Afghanistan. What?
Pakistani High Commissioner.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, so there are two. I'm glad to hear it. And also partly, I should add, that because I've spent some time in Afghanistan over the past year evaluating the United Nations Development Programme. And I agree very much with what everybody has said, that both Iraq and Afghanistan are incredibly important to get right. And what I think we have to tell ourselves is that there is at the moment in the world a real security gap. That is to say, there are large parts of the world which are deeply insecure from a whole range of reasons, of which Iraq and Afghanistan are maybe the worst. And actually, our current security arrangements are extremely ill-adapted to meeting that security gap. It constantly amazes me that we have in Europe 1.8 million men under arms, but we're simply not able either to deploy large numbers or to use them in the way they need to be used. And I really, for me, I think we need to rethink security. And it doesn't matter to me whether it's NATO rethinking it, the United Nations, or the European Union. I'm not concerned about which organization. My concern is, how are we going to solve these incredibly difficult problems that, if we fail to solve, I think could have very, very serious implications for the future and for future generations. And I think that's the way to think about it. Second thing I wanted to say is, when thinking about security, I think it's very important to start from the point of view of the security of people on the ground, individuals, men, women, and children, and the communities in which they live, rather than starting from a perspective of a war between our values and Islamic extremism. I think most of the people on the ground share our values, actually. And I don't think it's just Islamic extremism. There are all kinds of extremisms in the world today. And there are all kinds of conditions which give rise to this, which include weak states, weak institutions, the spread of a criminalized economy, unemployment, the availability of small arms, all of these things that we talk about when we talk about the need for a civilian military effort. The third thing I wanted to say was about the nature of what's going on in Afghanistan. You know, again, both the Secretary General and ESPIN said, well, we really have to support the government of Karzai. But you have to bear in mind that the government of Karzai includes many of the warlords, many of the poppy growers. When the Secretary General says, let us build an army and a police to establish security, you have to understand that many of the militias of those warlords are in the army and in the police and are among the biggest human rights abusers. So in that situation, if you're somebody living in a village in Helmand, who do you think is going to bring you the most security? And if on top of it, in NATO's effort to defeat the Taliban, you happen to destroy a lot of homes and kill many civilians and say, look, really sorry, we had good intentions, where do you stand as a local villager in Helmand? And I think this is the challenge that we face, and I think there is a role for military force. But it's a role for military force really in protecting people and villages, and that has to come intellectually, strategically, before the argument that we have to defeat the Taliban, because every time you destroy a whole lot of villages, you create more supporters of the Taliban. And thinking about that and thinking about very new ways in which military operate together with police, together with civilians, seems to be the major challenge at the moment, and it's one we really have to confront. Thinking about how we engage with civil society, people on the ground who know the situation, who understand it, again, that's one of the big challenges that we face today. So I think there's an argument to be had, and whether NATO can adapt in that way, because NATO is par excellence an institution of the Cold War. It was designed for wars against enemies. On the other hand, NATO is the biggest military infrastructure we have, so is there a way that NATO can radically rethink its role and adapt and act in new ways? And Afghanistan is a real challenge to NATO here. That has to be done. Well, those are all the remarks I wanted to make, but I just wanted to get in my two penneth worth, and now I open the floor for questions and debate. Yeah, the lady right at the back. Both of you, why don't you come up, and is there a... You have to come all the way to the front, unfortunately. And maybe the lady behind you, who also had a question... Was there one? You. Come, both of you come up, because that way we'll...
Hello, I'm Heather Young. I'm an intern at NATO in the Public Diplomacy Division. My question relates to EU-NATO relations. And we spoke of duplication in missions. I know we have the Berlin Plus, where the EU can come to NATO for military support. What is your opinion on reversing or extending that so NATO could go to the EU for civil reconstruction things, where I think that would help curb the duplication because organizations could focus on what they are best suited to do?
Thank you. And now let's take the other question at the same time.
I'm Yang Liu from University of Bristol. I've got a question really for the first speaker. I don't know whether you could speak on behalf of NATO. If you don't, I'd appreciate to hear your personal interpretations or my comments on my question. It's really because speakers hinted to the questions about energy security. Given the grand debate about the changing concepts of energy security these days, it seems to be the concept is more... moved away from pure geostrategic perspective energy-related issue. So energy security has been given more aspects of interpretation. So against this background, what is the conceptualizations of NATO's energy security value? And in defending the shared North Atlantic nations' common value towards the energy security, what is or what will be NATO's role, or what kind of role NATO can play in the new global energy security challenges? And more importantly, what more contribution energy could add into the alliance apart from traditional military dilemma? Thank you.
Of course, we're going to have the next session on energy security, but if our panelists would like to answer these two questions, that's great. Do you want, who would like to start? Espen.
Okay. On the first question on EU-NATO relations, first, I fully agree that we have a problem and it should be solved, and I am not impressed by the way that neither of us have been able really to address that in a fundamental way. I think, of course, it's a compelling argument to say that let each organization do what it does best, but it is not that easy because the two organizations are expressions of two different fundamental political ideas. One is the value of a transatlantic partnership in the political security realm, The other one is the European integration effort. Both are here to stay. I think the European integration, despite of the, in my view, regrettable fact that my country is not part of it, is here to stay, and it's broadening in scope, and it's a logical development that the EU is also developing a military ambition on top of its broad civilian ambition. On the other hand, I think it is perfectly possible to let that happen, to see that happening inside of a broader transatlantic partnership in which NATO provides a forum for political debates and for military cooperation between most, if not all, of the EU states on the one hand and the US and Canada on the other side. But there are some challenges in this area which has the characteristic that they are more difficult in theory than in practice. And sometimes it's better to try to solve them out there in reality, as we've been trying to do in the case of Bosnia, and as we're arguing for doing in as part of the attempt to get better grip with the integrated approach to Afghanistan, than to develop very clear principle lines, because some allies have very strong views on how to narrow the scope of at least one of the organizations. And this is a challenge that we share and we discuss, and it's quite high on the agenda of NATO, as I think it is on the agenda of the EU. I think, but just my point here is, recognize the different origins of these two projects and find a way to see how they can coexist in a constructive way. On energy, I don't know how far we should go into it. I have a lot of views about that, but I think the short question is that NATO can obviously only play a partial role. Energy security is very much about regulating the market and getting clear norms for in the interest both of producer and consumers and so on. But there are issues about surveillance of sea routes. There are issues about military presence in case unexpected developments take place. There are also issues that military organizations can provide better than anybody else about finding out what's going on, which is sometimes important. And so I think our argument is that NATO should also take part in that broader debate, but it should not be the forum for solving all the energy security related issues, because many of them are clearly outside of the military realm and should not be militarized there's no need to.
Well, it would be very nice if the EU and NATO could have a very clear functional division of labor, but I agree with my colleague. I think it is very hard to see that happening. I think the great pity is that, politics is clearly involved here, and both the EU is clearly seeking to have a military role as well, and so the distribution of labor they have arrived at is that the EU will do the softer end of things, and NATO will do the harder end of things. I mean, writing about these things regularly, it all seems to be a little frustrating, because fundamentally NATO doesn't have any soldiers, and neither does the EU. We're talking about the soldiers of nation governments. So in a way, there's too much hot air expressed in these sorts of issues by political leaders, and I think that in a sense is emblematic of many of the problems of our institutional arrangements that I've been pointing to. I think clearly the EU, whether you say it should be at the softer end of military things or not, clearly has a remarkable range of levers at its disposal, economically, the potential for perhaps deploying gendarmerie-type forces, of bringing together all of the aid and social and economic development side of the equation, and it's perhaps a shame maybe that the EU hasn't concentrated and done rather more there, since we hear so often criticism of NATO. Just a very quick point on the energy. I don't want to go into that in a big way, but I mean, you know, we hear a lot of talk about the information highway and the internet and so on. Well, still, the most important highway for energy are the high seas, and NATO naval forces, though they're not very much in the headlines, most of the conflicts at the moment appear to be very much land-based, but nonetheless, the defense and security of important shipping and sea lanes clearly seems to me to be a very important element of the energy security equation, and one at which NATO is clearly well equipped to deal with.
Okay, let me take a few more comments. Two more here. Why don't you both come up? I know, and I think that's... Come up too, and then you can each ask a question, because that way we'll take two each time.
Okay, my name is Anne Whitman. I'm a Canadian lawyer doing graduate work at the LSE. My question is for the representative of Norway. I was struck by something the Secretary General said in his response to one of Professor Calder's questions. He said that Canadian soldiers are dying in the Hindu Kush for our values. I can tell you that the Canadian public does not find this argument particularly compelling, not because we are not used to sending our men in harm's way to defend our values. We are used to doing that, and we have a proud record of that. The part the Canadian public doesn't understand is the Hindu Kush. The Secretary General also went through a list of successes that the international community has enjoyed in Afghanistan, including the public participation of women and the end of the Taliban regime. While those successes are important, I know from my own work in the Balkans that it's not so much that objective list of successes as what the Afghan people or what the local people expected in relation to the objective list. And I was very struck by something you said about convincing the average Pashtun person that this was a good idea for them. And my question is, why are we not good at that? And how can we be better? Because I think if we were better at that, the Canadian public would be more convinced by the argument.
Good question.
Hello, my name is Gilna Rybett. I'm a lecturer at the University of Kent and a senior associate at St. Anthony's at Oxford. I suppose my question is both to Mary Calder and to Jonathan Marcus, because what they have said touches upon what I want to ask. And the Secretary General mentioned this morning about the need for better coordination in Afghanistan between the NGOs and IGOs, and I think Jonathan Marcus also touched upon that in his talk. Regarding that, I was wondering what lessons can be drawn from Bosnia, where you had a very rigid template called the Dayton Agreement, whereby the job share between the institutions was very rigidly laid out. But I suppose the essence of the question is, even if we did have something as rigidly planned as the Dayton framework in Afghanistan, the story doesn't end there, because 10 years on, in Bosnia, state central institutions are still very weak. And the essence of the problem in the Balkans, especially in Bosnia, is this large-scale alienation at the grassroots level. What you sort of mentioned this morning about the general sort of trust building among just ordinary people. And I suppose how you address that question with regard to Afghanistan and the lessons that have been learned in Bosnia. If we take about the Balkans in general, nowadays, we're sort of realizing more and more that conditionality is a very important tool in conveying these values that we've been talking about through institutions to the grassroots level. In other words, trying to get a mindset that says, if the country as a whole does well, I do well as an individual. That is still lacking in Bosnia. Now, how to convey that to Afghanistan? I suppose my key question is, what is the conditionality there that you can convey to the grassroots level? And not just Afghanistan, lots of other countries in the region. What does it mean if you say, well, to an individual, if you join NATO's Partnership for Peace, you're going to be better off, or if you join the EU's European Neighbourhood Policy? These do not really translate to any meaningful terms of well-being for individual citizens. So I suppose that's the essence of my question. Thank you.
Well, thank you for those questions. And I guess, do you want to start, Espen?
I started last.
And I think I have to say
something. Okay, too. Yeah, sure. First to Anne Whitman from Canada. I have to say that we have a very great respect for the efforts Canada is doing, and a very deep understanding of the political challenges related to that very serious commitment that Canada has as one of the strongest commitments to the most complicated parts of Afghanistan. My country and many other countries have many troops in Afghanistan as well, but we have been placed in other parts of the country, and for the moment at least we have taken much less of a toll than you have and a few other countries, I have to say that. To your very important question, again, I don't think we have the simple answer to that. Why are we not good enough? But I do think there is something that should be said here, which is that NATO, ISAF, is very new in South Afghanistan. It was another military operation that took the military part of that job for the first 4 years. And I think with hindsight, as General Richards himself have said, that there may be things that were not done in such a helpful way at the time. If we can draw a distinction between the global war on terror in its most narrow sense, which is look for the terrorists and arrest them or get rid of them, and on the other hand, the sort of long-term stabilization of Afghanistan peace-building approach, I think ISAF is there with a stronger focus on the long-term peace-building stabilization of Afghanistan mandate. It's a UN mandate, as the Secretary General said, and it's a right mandate, and it's a mandate that is linked into the overarching strategy. But we started late. So the question is if we definitely have lost important years in that part of the country. The question is, of course, is it too late, or can it be recoupled? I'm not saying that the stabilization of Afghanistan part is not part of the global or the global fight to get rid of the cause of terror, but it's in a broader interpretation and probably a more promising interpretation, because individual Pashtuns in complicated areas were not born Taliban or born pro-Karzai or born pro-Canada or born anti-Canada. They adapt to a changing security environment, and they have several decades, or if not hundreds of years of experience, and is that the safest bet is to go for those who look like they will be winning. And if that seems to be the Taliban, they will support the Taliban. And if that seems to be the big internationally supported Karzai project with all the complications that you very correctly point out, they will hopefully support them. And that's why an integrated, holistic effort, which is a strong military component, but where the military component is injected into a strategic perception of how to convince them, is what we urgently need. And I think we have to do better as an alliance in inviting the other partners and convincing them that we have to do this together in an effective way. Quick on coordination, the question on Bosnia. Yes, I think we had some experiences from the Balkans which could be applied also to Afghanistan in new operations. I think actually that Kosovo is a better example than Bosnia, because yes, the Dayton Agreement set out all the different tasks. There was elections, there were police, building police, there were military presence, there were all the civilian tasks. But they were then handed out to different organizations, and it took quite some time before we started to talk together about how to apply them in a concerted way. Eventually, we had this Peace Implementation Council, which was such a forum. When NATO and the UN moved from Bosnia to Kosovo, this is after the Kosovo War, but when the stabilization effort began, there was a rather clear structure of UNMIC, the UN lead on the civilian side, which again took into its sort of responsibility what the EU and the OSCE and other organizations would do. And they worked on a daily basis with KFOR, which was the NATO organization, intertwined on all levels. And I think that was probably a reasonably effective example of stabilization. It's not perfect, but there was something there. I think there's something here we're lacking in Afghanistan. My last point, Mary, is one thing you said. Yes, we are not sufficiently well organized to deal with these new challenges. The proof is that there are many wars and conflicts around. But I think it should also be said that of the very last years, we've seen a number of successes. It's in Liberia. Seems to be a success. Maybe it works this time. Since Sierra Leone, much, much better. It was a terrible war some years ago, one of the most brutal civil wars. But there is some kind of order, there's some kind of belief in the future. But they are at the point in which, if we don't get the development actors in an effective way, what has been gained on the military political field will be lost. But there are some signs of progress, even in the extremely complicated, eternally troubled DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo. There has been elections. There have been international efforts that have been underpinning some kind of progress in the most complicated issues. And now we have, beyond Iraq and Afghanistan, we have the Sudan, in which my country, by the way, is planning to contribute militarily if there is a UN operation in Darfur, and which I very much appreciate the efforts that the Secretary General himself has done to put NATO also on that agenda, without saying that it's a NATO job, but it's a NATO support to a broader effort. So it's not only failure. There are examples of success. So we should try to extract what was it that created some successes, and how can we try to apply that where we are in trouble. That's, I think, the challenge coming up with this.
I'm going to come back to you in a minute, but I'm going to let Jonathan come first.
Well, I think that why does the Hindu Kush matter? I mean, obviously, there's the wider question of failed societies and bases for terrorist entities and so on. But I mean, the argument that's made in Britain by many government ministers is the drug problem, which is apparently the link between Afghanistan and what is happening on the high road in our cities. I think the problem there is that you see no really clear coordinated strategy on drugs in Afghanistan. It's not the military's role to destroy the poppy fields. There are no clear ways of providing alternative income for the Afghan farmers. Nobody is prepared to buy up the poppy crops for successive years to provide some sort of breathing space there. So the security problems continue. I think the comparison with Bosnia is interesting. I think with the Balkans generally is interesting. I think, though, that, you know, the security situation and context in each of these areas is very, very different. You may well argue that many more troops are needed in Afghanistan. You may argue that NATO planners made some fairly serious errors in their appreciation of the situation. You might argue that 2 or 3 years shouldn't have been lost fighting operations somewhere else. You might actually argue that the way the war was originally fought by the Americans, where the principal warlords were kind of co-opted into an irregular force, and then that was leavened with some, and leverage was applied with some American high technology, that set the scene for the problems that Mr. Karzai's government has not surprisingly had. And I think the starting points in the Balkans and Afghanistan were radically different. In the Balkans, it was much clearer. You had a defeated enemy, you had an occupied, in both cases, or you had countries who had exhausted themselves through war, or you had them occupied by very, very sizable numbers of NATO troops.
I'm also very grateful for the question, for the comparison with Bosnia, because it gives me a chance to explain what I mean and also to answer Espen's last point. I think it's true that the international community has, over the last 5 years, learnt how to stabilize conflicts. But I think the problem is the emphasis on stability rather than the security of individuals and communities. And what you see in many African countries, as well as in the Balkans, is that, yes, and also to some extent in Afghanistan, yes, overt conflict has been stopped. But nevertheless, people still feel a sense of deep insecurity. And actually, it's fascinating because I think it's also the case in the economic field. You know, budgets, it's the same in Afghanistan and Bosnia. Budgets have been stabilized, you've got rapid rates of growth, and yet you have enormously high levels of joblessness and people forced to become part of the criminal economy because it's the only way they can make a livelihood. And that's why I actually like, rather than, of course, Espen is right, you have to integrate the development and the civilian, but it's not just a matter of integration, it's a matter of principles. And that's why actually I always use the term human security, because it focuses your mind on the security of the individuals rather than simply stability. Now, in both Bosnia and Afghanistan, the warlords were brought in to bring an end to the conflict, and there was no alternative to that, but it meant that you ended up with very unsatisfactory forms of local government. But I think what there was an alternative was the focus on ending the conflict failed to make it clear that you really need to involve civil society, you really need to involve women, you really need to have that human security perspective in mind. Along at the same time, it's not that you stabilize and along come the development agencies and they have to solve the problem. By that time, the political institutions have been established and it's extremely difficult for them to do anything. You've actually got to have them engaged and involved from the beginning, and you've got to have that perspective in mind, and I think that's what's at the moment lacking. Finally, just one little point in answer to Jonathan about NATO versus Europe, hard versus soft. I'm very unhappy with this language of hard versus soft. I think it's actually old. Well, I don't want to say old versus new, but NATO is built around an old version of security in which hard security means tanks and airplanes defending against an enemy. And Petersburg tasks peacekeeping, instability, is somehow supposed to be soft. But I actually don't think it is soft. I think if you're really trying to help people preserve security, you sometimes have to use soldiers in hard ways and ways that are a lot riskier than when you're bombing from however many meters up. So I actually think doing Petersburg tasks is hard, not soft, and I think that's one of the problems the European Union has, that it thinks it's just doing soft stuff. And again, back to what I said before, I don't care who does it, whether it's NATO or EU. Now, I think we just have one more question, and then we finish. Yes, you. Finally, we've got a man. Gender balance is restored.
Professor Calder, distinguished speakers, Your Excellency Secretary General, my name is Marko Kovacevic. I'm from the Atlantic Council of Serbia, and first of all, I would like really to congratulate to the organizers for this kind of the event, because for us, especially I think from Balkans, this way of engagement and this way of communication is very important. I wanted to add a question for the all of the panelists, but I will give just a brief introduction why I stood up and why I would like to do it now is because two distinguished colleagues just before me mentioned the Balkans as such, and I think that it is an interesting situation there, and we are a hotspot in a way, but we are in area, if I can say like that. And relating to the things on which we are working together through the project, which is called the Balkan Mosaic, which is done with a great help from our Norwegian colleagues and the Atlantic Council of Norway, and which is directly related to the developments in Balkans and raising the awareness related to security and NATO in a way, which is like, we can say, a bottom-up approach, which was mentioned and which is very important from the citizens to be seen. But I would like to refer a question to your comments, which is related to an idea which is appearing in the region, because recently we are seeing the big gap between the progress of the nations inside the Balkans towards the Euro-Atlantic integration. So is this a threat in a way? Because if we have countries like Bosnia and Herzegovina, Serbia and Montenegro now, which are at the grassroots, still not members of the PFP, and trying to change the public awareness for Serbia, for instance, and Montenegro, very soon after the 99, the positive examples and, you know, the good feedback coming from the Brussels is a crucial thing, because people see that the things are not happening at all, but the conditions are expanding. So when we work on the level where we work, you know, with a cooperation, for instance, in Balkan Mosaic, direct cooperation with Brussels, which is really great, we need a push-up in the other way, like where we see those three countries related to the Partnership for Peace. Is there a chance that the things will happen recently? And then we can follow up, you know, with the Croatia, Adriatic Charter countries, Croatia, Macedonia, and Albania, because Bulgaria and Romania are already, you know, two steps ahead. They're joining the European Union now, January 2007. So will this gap in between countries who are, in a way, pretty tight together, and the cooperation is happening, and the things are moving, especially on the younger generation level, you know, this can be a huge push-up, or it can be a big threat. Thank you.
Okay. I'll let Jonathan go first and Aspen second.
Well, look, I mean, it's clear that, I mean, this, in a sense, is unfinished business, and to a significant extent, I think, unfortunately, the world's attention has moved elsewhere. Where's he gone? He's over there. I mean, I think one of the greatest problems we face is this problem of fatigue, of trying to do too many things in too many places. And it's quite clear that in many ways, certainly in terms of the application of financial resources, the eye has been taken off the ball somewhat in the Balkans. I think you're quite right to highlight this, but I think this, in a sense, is part of a much wider problem. If you look at particularly, I mean, EU funding, but across the board, if you look at a trouble spot and you look at the money that is voted for places and the plans that are made and the institutions that are set up, almost in every single case, the reality never matches the promises. Budgetary problems intervene, another crisis emerges somewhere else. That's where attention moves to. And so there is a danger, I think, of a sort of a stasis and of... and I think one of the key pointers to that is the fact that we still have so many troops in the region now, so long after the immediate conflict. And even though everybody keeps saying, well, this is now the moment that we're going to resolve all these things and the status of Kosovo and so on and so forth, actually it is only now that we're really coming to grips with the problem, and we perhaps have not in the intervening years got to the jumping off point which would have made it much easier now to resolve, if you like, what you might call these final status issues.
Okay, Espen.
Thank you. I agree with most of what you said, but I would like to defend NATO a little bit. I think most of what NATO has been doing in reality has been on what you... and what some people refer to as the soft side, actually. Yeah. I mean, although we were planning for a really hardcore, hard power exchange with the Soviet Union and back when. I mean, what has happened on the ground has been in this new concept, and I think NATO, as other organizations, has learned and adapted and developed further on that, those experiences, first from the Balkans, now increasingly in Afghanistan. And I think going there, as I know you do, you will meet a lot of military people on all levels who have a very strong conviction and understanding of them being a part of a holistic approach. And very often asking the question, where are the NGOs? We are here to help. I mean, we're here to provide security, that something else can happen, but we can't see there's something else happening. That is at least not solely NATO's responsibility. It's something that goes beyond, and why I keep referring to the international community. Human security, Mary did not say, but I can say that she contributed to a human security doctrine document for the EU, which is an excellent and really interesting suggestion for a way to think about this. This can very well be read outside of EU quarters as well. A lot to be learned from that. I think that you are right in saying that there is an eternal challenge in finding the trade-off between stability, which at times includes liaising with a number of bad guys to get rid of other bad guys, and on the other hand, real progress and justice and modernity and democracy. I still think, as an fundamental optimist, a realist optimist, but still an optimist, that we see some development in the international community's approach to conflict from the early 90s to now, where we are more eager to assist transformation rather than return to status quo. That there are, at least in principle and in ambition, there is democracy, there is equal rights, there is sort of outreach to the outside of the capital. Many of these things are in the mandates that we're trying to implement. Yet we may not be good enough at doing it, but this ambition is there, and I think it's possible because of the end of the Cold War, because before 1990, you could not say in the UN Security Council that democracy is better than one-party rule. No, you can. You could not say that human rights is better than arbitrary arrest, because half of the members said the opposite. No, you can. There is some kind of progress, and which means that this transformative approach is more viable, so we just have to learn to get it right. There is one interesting development which relates to this this debate in UN reform, which is the establishment of the Peacebuilding Commission. And I don't belong to those who think that you solve the problem by establishing a commission. But this Peacebuilding Commission at least addresses a real issue, which is what do you do when the CNN effect is gone, and when the Security Council and when NATO, whoever, has its focus elsewhere? Where do you place a conflict that is beyond immediate violence, but still not really stable? And this Peacebuilding Commission has now addressed two particular countries, Burundi and Sierra Leone, as a kind of pilot project to see how can we try to focus the international effort to keep strategic, even if we're not there in a purely military setting. I think that's promising. So our Serbian friend, as you know, we have been trying to help the new forces in Serbia since the peaceful revolution in 2000. I strongly believe that, again, as an international community, we have not done good enough in capitalizing on the progress that was achieved. It was very right to demand for the handover of war crime suspects, but we should have been better at also helping the people to reap the fruits of this development in a better way than we have. And I think that we all, everybody who knows the Balkan to a certain extent, would say that there is no real permanent answer if Serbia is not the inside of it. As long as Serbia is on the outside, we have a remaining problem in the Balkans, and that is so why it's so important to have a strategic engagement with the many good forces of Serbia. Thank you.
Thank you both. I didn't want to imply that NATO was less good at adapting than anyone else. I was merely objecting to this use of the term hard and soft.
Okay.
But what I do, and I also think it's absolutely true that the international community has over the last 10 years, 15 years, undergone a learning experience, and we're on the cusp, if you like, of a paradigm change. Nevertheless, I think the focus on stabilization has actually meant that we've created situations where the international community is there and can't leave, and that's why we're overstretched. And without a real focus on human security, as I would call it, I think it's really going to be very, very difficult ever to develop exit strategies, and it's really going to be difficult to solve the problems in Afghanistan and Iraq, where it's not only a problem of stability, it's also a problem of a mixing up human security with the war on terror. Mm. So thank you all very much for this session, and we come back. I'm really sorry, I went over time, and this is a... So we're supposed to come back in 5 minutes, I think.